Now I'm going to read from Deuteronomy chapter 10. It's a long reading because I'm going to go into chapter 11 too, right to the end. But this is really a reading to prepare you for the book of Joshua. It gives you a flavor for where Israel was at this crucial period in her history. So I begin at Deuteronomy 10 verse 12. You must imagine that Moses is addressing the congregation of Israel on the bank of Jordan before they cross and begin to take possession of the promised land. This is his final sermon to them. And now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today for your own good. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth and everything in it. Yet the Lord set his affection on your forefathers and loved them. And he chose you, their descendants, above all the nations, as it is today. Circumcise your hearts, therefore, and do not be stiff-necked any longer, for the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the alien, giving him food and clothing. And you are to love those who are aliens, for you yourselves were aliens in Egypt. Fear the Lord your God and serve him. Hold fast to him and take your oaths in his name. He is your praise. He is your God who performed for you those great and awesome wonders you saw with your own eyes. Your forefathers who went down into Egypt were 70 in all, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars in the sky. Love the Lord your God, and keep his requirements, his decrees, his laws, and his commands always. Remember today that your children were not the ones who saw and experienced the discipline of the Lord your God, his majesty, his mighty hand, his outstretched arm, the signs he performed, and the things he did in the heart of Egypt, both to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his whole country. What he did to the Egyptian army, to its horses and chariots, how he overwhelmed them with the waters of the Red Sea as they were pursuing you, and how the Lord brought lasting ruin on them. It was not your children who saw what he did for you in the desert until you arrived at this place, and what he did to Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, the Reubenite, when the earth opened its mouth right in the middle of all Israel and swallowed them up with their households, their tents, and every living thing that belonged to them. But it was your own eyes that saw all these great things the Lord has done. Observe, therefore, all the commands I'm giving you today, so that you may have the strength to go in and take over the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, and so that you may live long in the land that the Lord swore to your forefathers to give to them and to their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. The land you are entering to take over is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you planted your seed and irrigated it by foot as in a vegetable garden. But the land you are crossing the Jordan to take possession of is a land of mountains and valleys that drinks rain from heaven. It is a land the Lord your God cares for the eyes of the Lord your God are continually on it from the beginning of the year to its end. So if you faithfully obey the commands I'm giving you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will send rain on your land in its season, both autumn and spring rains, so that you may gather in your grain, new wine and oil. I will provide grass in the fields for your cattle, and you will eat and be satisfied. Be careful, or you will be enticed to turn away and worship other gods and bow down to them. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you, and he will shut the heavens so that it will not rain, and the ground will yield no produce, and you will soon perish from the good land the Lord is giving you. Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your children may be many in the land that the Lord swore to give your forefathers, as many as the days that the heavens are above the earth. If you carefully observe all these commands I'm giving you to follow, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out all these nations before you, and you will dispossess nations larger and stronger than you. Every place where you set your foot will be yours, from the desert to Lebanon, and from the Euphrates River to the Western Sea. No man will be able to stand against you. The Lord your God, as he promised you, will put the terror and fear of you on the whole land wherever you go. See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commands of the Lord your God that I'm giving you today, the curse if you disobey the commands of the Lord your God and turn from the way that I command you today by following other gods which you have not known. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land you are entering to possess, you are to proclaim on Mount Gerizim the blessings and on Mount Ebal the curses. As you know, these mountains are across the Jordan, west of the road toward the setting sun, near the great trees of Moreh, in the territory of those Canaanites living in the Arabah in the vicinity of Gilgal. You are about to cross the Jordan to enter and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you. When you have taken it over and are living there, be sure that you obey all the decrees and laws I'm setting before you today. Choices. We all make choices, don't we? Every day. Most of them, I suppose, seem rather trivial, determined more by habit than by conscious deliberation. But sometimes, too, we have to make big choices, don't we? Shall I change my job? Shall I marry this girl? Shall we have a child? Big choices that aren't trivial or insignificant at all, but there's no opting out of them in human life, is there? It's just the way we're made. We human beings are creatures of self-determination. That is our nobility, even though it is a problem to us sometimes. To be human is to choose. It's to take responsibility for our lives. We're not like computers that just have programs tapped into them, nor are we just like animals that live by instinct. We have this power to decide our direction in life. What an awesome responsibility it is. What's more, if that's true for us as individuals, that we have the power of choice, it's also true for us corporately as societies. Put any group of human beings together, and you will find they don't behave as a mere collection of random atoms, each doing their own thing without regard to the others. Within a very short space of time, you will find they are demonstrating a social psychology. A corporate consciousness develops among them. So they start doing things together, making decisions together. The philosopher Rousseau talked about the general will. He had this idea that society has a kind of will of its own. I suppose these days we talk rather more about public opinion polls, or rather more individualistic. But both reflect the same fundamental social reality, that groups of people, societies, also make collective choices. Even nations make choices. In a month's time, our nation will be making a choice. Well, here in this passage that we've read, indeed in this whole book of Deuteronomy, we encounter Israel at a time in her history when she too had a choice to make. It was a great watershed in her national life. Moses is addressing her, this valedictory sermon of his that we call the book of Deuteronomy, he's addressing her as she stands on the brink of the River Jordan. 40 years or so, the people have been wandering in the desert. Now, at last, the moment has come when they will invade the land God had promised and begin to take possession of it. It was a great moment. But of course, during those 40 years, after their exit from Egypt, until they had arrived at this crucial point on the bank of Jordan, the vast majority of adults had died. It was those who had been children in the land of Egypt, those under the age of 20 or so, who had survived and were standing there with Moses now. Only Moses and a couple of others had been adults when that exodus from Egypt had taken place. As they prepare then to embark on this daring enterprise, Moses feels led by God to renew the covenant with them. The covenant which they had made at Sinai just a few weeks after they left Egypt. But he's renewing that covenant with the children, as it were, of those who had been adults when it was first made. He's saying, listen, you have a choice to make. You're standing on the threshold of your national destiny. Things could go either way from you from here on. On the one hand, you could discover prosperity and peace. On the other hand, you could inherit poverty and war. Prophet though Moses is, he can't guarantee the future for them. Your destiny, he's saying, lies in your hands. It's conditional on this crucial choice that you must make now. It hinges on the commitment you make to obedience. God has given you his law. He's told you the kind of life he wants you to live as individuals and as a community. The fact that your parents faced that same choice 40 years ago doesn't make the issue any easier or any less momentous for you. For each new generation has the power to reaffirm or to abandon the faith of its forefathers. So he says the choice is yours. See how he puts it there in chapter 11, verse 26? I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. He tells them they must write this choice, this momentous choice, in the very geography of the promised land when they get to the other side of Jordan, fixing the blessing on one mountain and the curses on another, so that succeeding generations would always be confronted with that fundamental choice they have to make. A blessing if you obey the commands of the Lord your God, a curse if you disobey. Such simple logic. But it runs through the warp and woof of this whole book of Deuteronomy, and indeed informs the whole of the rest of the Old Testament. What reasons does Moses adduce for them choosing positively to obey? Why should they obey? Let me just briefly identify three reasons he gives them in this long passage we read. One reason he gives them is simple reverence for the person of God. Look at verse 12 of chapter 10. Now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God? You'll notice that word fear occurs again in verse 20. Fear the Lord your God and serve him. Because we usually associate that word fear, don't we, with an undesirable, kind of negative feeling, even a sign of cowardice. But when you think about it, there are times when it's perfectly necessary, even laudable, to have this emotional response of fear. Now, the world is a dangerous place. There are times when not to feel afraid would be insane. Sometimes it's the person who feels afraid who will be the more cautious and save themselves, where the reckless daredevil will simply, in his arrogance, plunge to ruin. To fear is to admit to ourselves that we are vulnerable, that we are insecure. To fear is to acknowledge that we are mere human beings, and there are things in this world, powers in this world, far greater and more formidable than we are. It's that kind of fear, that kind of reverence for that which surpasses us in our frailty and weakness, that Moses is calling the people of Israel to experience here in relation to God. To fear, he says, is to recognize that there is someone in this universe, bigger and more powerful than anything we can even imagine. See how he describes him in verse 17? The Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords. In other words, think of the biggest God, the biggest Lord you can, and then double it. The great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. Fear the Lord, he says. Moses is angling there for an emotional response, isn't he? In the way he heaps phrase upon phrase there to try to drive into the minds of these people that this God he's talking about is big. He's no puppet you can manipulate by your religious rituals. He's no abstraction you can theorize about in your philosophical debates. This God is the supreme sovereign. He cannot be overruled. There is no one who has the power to overrule him. He is the invincible warrior. He cannot be defeated. There is no one who has the power to conquer him. He is the righteous judge. He cannot be corrupted. His verdicts are absolutely unimpeachable. He is the superlative God, in other words. He must be worshipped. There is no other response appropriate to a God this big. So, he says, almost breathless under the weight of all this description, fear the Lord your God. Reverence for just how mighty he is. That's his first argument as to why they should obey. And I would have thought that it was great. It was just as powerful an argument for us. Wouldn't you? You must have had times in your life when you felt afraid. Perhaps you've stood, as I have, at the foot of a great waterfall and just been spellbound by the power of the rushing waters above your head and just fantasized for a moment. What on earth would it be like to fall into that plunging water? You just imagine it and you can make yourself absolutely terrified. Or maybe you've gone into a dark and empty house and suddenly shuddered with this uncanny kind of invisible presence that's gripped your heart. Is it imaginary? I mean, are there ghosts? Who knows? When you get into a dark, empty house, the most unsuperstitious of us suddenly begin to tremble sometimes, don't we? And reach for the light switch rather quickly. It had better go on, we say to ourselves. Or have you ever sat in a corridor waiting to see somebody very, very important? You know that feeling? The cold sweat breaking out on your brow as you wonder if you'll ever stop stammering long enough to speak when you get in there. Think of some of those experiences. Even if you've never known the raw terror of real fear that a soldier may have known in battle, or as I once knew when I nearly fell off a cliff once, you'll find something in your life where you got in touch with fear as an emotion. Don't you think that this God we have come to worship today merits such an emotional response from you? The Lord your God is God of gods, Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome. Fear him. Is that not one very strong reason for obeying his law? But Moses balances that with a second motive. Not only fear, reverence for the person of God, but gratitude also for the grace of God. Look again at verse 14. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth and everything in it. Yet the Lord set his affection on your forefathers and loved them. And he chose you, their descendants, above all the nations, as it is today. Again and again through this book, you will find Moses reminding the Israelites that their history had been, from cover to cover, the history of God's grace towards them. It was God's grace that had elected them before they even existed. He made a covenant, remember, with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the patriarchs, setting his affection, as he puts it here, on their forefathers. It was, says Moses, a quite incredibly generous thing to do. Do you notice that word, yet, in verse 15? It's a kind of disjunctive preposition there. Yet the Lord set his affection on your forefathers. Here's a God who scans the entire universe, who owns the cosmos. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth, and everything in it. Yet the Lord set his affection on your forefathers, an insignificant Middle Eastern tribe. Not only his grace, though, in electing them, in choosing them, but his grace also in multiplying them. Notice that in verse 22. Your forefathers who went down into Egypt were 70 in all. And now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars in the sky. That's the promise, of course, that he had made to Abraham. See if you can count the stars, Abraham, so will your descendants be. That's what God had said to him. And against all the odds, it had come true. In spite of Pharaoh's persecutions and the austerities of that wilderness wandering, here they are on the shoreline of the Jordan, a great company numbered in thousands, not just dozens any longer. That was God's grace, he says. But supremely, of course, Moses reminds them of God's grace in redeeming them. Do you see that in chapter 11, verses 2 to 4? This word we've been thinking about already tonight. Remember today that your children are not the ones who saw and experienced in the discipline of the Lord your God, his majesty, his mighty hand, his outstretched arm, the signs he performed, the things he did in the heart of Egypt, both to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his whole country, what he did to the Egyptian army, to its horses and chariots, how he overwhelmed them with the waters of the Red Sea, and so forth. You know the story. By any standards, the deliverance from Egypt was a remarkable event. Perhaps for the second generation of Israelites who had been in the wilderness, the story of that Exodus was already taking on the characteristic of a children's fairy tale. They had been very young when it had happened. And many of them, of course, hadn't actually been there themselves. They were children born in the wilderness to parents who had been there. This then was the last generation that would have eyewitness experience, as it were, of those formative events of their nation. A crucial generation. They had to pass on to their children the fact that this wasn't just a fantasy, this wasn't just a sort of George and the Dragon kind of story that you told children last thing at night. This was real. This had really happened. The plagues, the Red Sea, the miraculous incidents of the wilderness experience, this was not just a patriotic yarn or saga. This was what God had done. In their own experience, there were among them, standing on that riverbank, many, many people who could remember from their youth those things actually happening among them. Well, for goodness sake, don't forget it, says Moses. 40 years is a long while. Memories grow dim. It's crucial that you remember, because it was God's grace you experienced then. And he brought you out of Egypt in that quite miraculous way. He chose your forefathers. He's multiplied you as a people. He's redeemed you from slavery. Doesn't simple gratitude for all that divine favor demand then that you should obey him? Don't be stiff-necked any longer, he says in verse 16. Circumcise your hearts. Circumcision, of course, was a physical mark in the flesh that marked out the Jewish people. But by using it this way, circumcise your hearts, Moses is drawing a metaphorical kind of connection from it. He's saying, look, the kind of dedication that God really wants is not an external ceremony. It's an inner spiritual commitment. Circumcise your hearts. The time has come when you must choose. There must be no more stiff-necked spiritual obstinacy. God has shown great grace towards you. He deserves your love. And your love is what he is now seeking. Then, love the Lord your God and keep his requirements. That, I say, is Moses' second argument for choosing the path of obedience, the path of blessing. You may feel it's the most compelling of all, gratitude for grace. And I suggest to you it's every bit as relevant to you and me as it was to the Israelites. It's relevant to us who are believers, who are Christians here, because we too have been redeemed. Redeemed by the blood of the Lamb as surely as they were redeemed by the Passover. We've passed through the waters of baptism as surely as they had passed through the Red Sea. It's relevant too for us as a church. For God has multiplied us. Those of us who've been here any length of time at Eden can remember a time when we were much smaller in number, when our resources were much more diminutive. He's blessed us as a church. I think it's even of relevance to us as a nation. For this nation that most of us come from, this nation of Britain, is a nation with a Christian heritage. We should be grateful for that. It brings to us many blessings that others who live in lands without that heritage are denied, particularly those who want to follow Christ. That every new generation, you see, every new generation of members here at Eden, every new generation of citizens in our nation, we have a choice to make. The choice of whether we are going to identify with that heritage or whether we're going to abandon it. The fact that our parents made that covenant, says Moses, isn't good enough. It's your turn now to cross the Jordan. And that means commitment from you. There's one third motive, though, that Moses gives, and I suppose you could argue that it is the most dominant motive of all in this book of Deuteronomy. Though equally some may feel it's the most mercenary. Because Moses says not only does reverence for the person of God demand obedience, and gratitude for the grace of God demand obedience, he says desire for the reward of God demands obedience too. Behold, I am setting before you a blessing and a curse, verse 26. The blessing, if you obey the commands of the Lord your God that I'm giving you today. The curse, if you disobey. And in the verses preceding that, you'll notice from verse 8 in chapter 11 right through to verse 26, he's outlining exactly what that blessing consists of. The promised land, for a start, in verse 8. A marvelous land, he says, a land of milk and honey, quite unlike the desert of Egypt, which had to be worked by irrigation to make it fertile. This land will be rained upon from above. There'll be immense future prosperity, he says in verse 13. If you faithfully obey the commands I'm giving you to love the Lord your God and serve him with all your heart and soul, because then God will send the rain on your land in its season, and you'll have grass in the fields for your cattle, and grain and new wine and oil in your barns. You will eat and be satisfied. Land and fertility and rain and peace and security too in verse 22. If you carefully observe all these commands, notice again the condition, to love the Lord your God, then the Lord your God will drive out all these pagan nations before you, and you will dispossess nations larger and stronger than you are. See, as Israel stood on the bank of Jordan, she knew the territory she was about to invade was already occupied by people who were numerically stronger than she was, and many of them possessed military technology in advance of her too. Only God could win the battles upon which their long-term survival in that land hinged. And he says that blessing, too, depended on obedience. God had been gracious up to them, in all kinds of ways up to this point. But now he is, as it were, calling them to prove that his grace would continue with them as they continued in their commitment to him. But he's warning them too. He will not continue indefinitely to bless a people who turn their backs on him. I'm setting before you today a blessing and a curse. Reverence then for the person of God, gratitude for the grace of God. Maybe it does seem a little mercenary. But Moses is realistic, isn't he, about our human hearts when he says, well, if neither of those arguments will work on you, maybe this one will. Do you really want God's reward or not? Do you want to experience his blessing in your life as a people? That's the choice that he's confronting them with as they stand on the brink of Jordan. You have every reason to obey this God, because of the God he is, because of the grace he has shown you, because of the reward he holds out to you. I set before you then today a blessing and a curse. Maybe there are some of us who, as individuals, stand on the brink of some Jordan right now. I guess there may be one or two students still around, or postgrads whose courses are coming to an end at this time of the year, and you're thinking, I wonder where I'll be next October, next September. I wonder if some opportunity for a job is going to turn up, or whether I'm going to be in the dole queue. Maybe some of us are feeling some sense of vocation, Christian service maybe. Some new enterprise that we're about to launch out into in the not-too-distant future. Maybe some of us feel we've come to the spiritual crossroads in our lives in some way. Some change of direction is being demanded of us. Maybe we feel insecure, a little afraid, as I imagine the Israelites must have done as they stood on the bank of Jordan, wondering what exactly they would find when they crossed those waters. Perhaps then the feel of this book of Deuteronomy is a feel that's relevant to you personally just at this time. Perhaps God is saying to you, I am a great God, I am a gracious God, and my reward is with me. When you cross the Jordan, make sure then you cross it holding my hand, committed to obey my word. Perhaps as a church, in some respects, we stand on the brink of Jordan. Perhaps as a church, there are new challenges, new decisions that have to be made in the not too distant future. Where do we go from here? In term time, this building is full. Over at Morley, they're bursting at the seams too. Where do we go from here? I set before you this day a blessing and a curse. Choices have to be made, you see. And even I sense for our nation as a whole, that text is far from irrelevant. We have a general election. It could very easily be a general election which will change the political direction of our country in quite a significant way. But in which new direction? We have a Christian heritage. But each new generation must own it, or it will be gone. I was talking to someone in the States about The fact that all the opinion polls are showing John Major rather seriously behind, and he was expressing some bewilderment about why that should be. After all, he says, you look at the economic indicators. They're all very good, you know. From our side over here, everything that you're supposed to do if you're a prime minister, supposed to achieve in order to guarantee re-election, he's done. The economy's growing, the pound is okay, the balance of payments under control, taxation has come down a bit. Your people are getting richer, not poorer, as each year goes by. Why is everybody so against him, poor fella? Well, to tell you the truth, I had to say, you know, that is a mystery to me too. There is something strange about the social psychology of this country in that respect. But I also had to tell him this. I think you can date the beginning of the declines in the fortunes of the Conservative Party in this country to that vexed period of time when, though it seemed a trivial matter to many of them, the fight was going on about whether we should allow shops to open on Sundays or not. I happen to know that quite a number of significant Christian folk in this country stopped praying for the continuation of the Conservative government at that time. And it seems to me the story has been one of declining fortunes ever since. Sometimes quite mysteriously declining. I'm not wishing in any way to be sort of superstitious or silly about it. But an important decision was taken by our government at that time, a few years back, about how it felt about the Christian heritage of our land. It would not surprise me if they and we do not pay a price for that decision, if we're not prepared to see it reversed. See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commands of the Lord your God that I'm giving you today. The curse if you disobey. The power of choice is a frightening one, isn't it? Terrifying, really, that we can make a decision with our conscious minds which changes the course of our lives, changes the course of our families' lives, changes the course, in one way or another, of many, many lives, perhaps even the very direction and history of the world itself. One little choice. And that choice is ours. Let's pray together.